So the last three of these 10 precepts are mind precepts. We had the body precepts were not killing, not taking what's not given, not misusing sexuality, the speech, and you could put that in. Yeah, it's almost like that. Almost like kind of pervades all the others in a way. It's sort of like here it says like not selling the wine of delusion. Right? And so we say intoxicating self or others. In a way, that precept, I see it more as there's nothing inherently unethical about that, but it's added in because so often with intoxication, we then go against all these other ethical precepts. So it's almost like it's not exactly body, speech, or mind. It's more like the one that influences all the others. It's one way we could see it. And then the speech ones are not lying or speaking falsely, not speaking of others' faults, and not praising self and belittling others. And then, so we think of usually like ethical conduct or ways of harmonizing beings as with our body and speech. That's the way we really affect others. But these last three are mind precepts. So in that way, they're harder to keep. And no one maybe even notices if we are or not there. We could say they're not outwardly directly harming others, but in fact, they're the root of all the other ways we feel separate from beings and harm them. So greed, hate, and delusion, we say the three poisons are greed, hate, and delusion. And greed and hate are based on delusion. From the point of view of Buddha, the root delusion is like the belief that we are a separate self, not one with all beings, and this basic duality of self and other, you could say that delusion is the cause for grasping or greed, feeling there's something outside ourself that we need to get. It's based on the delusion of duality, or anger, aversion, hatred is trying to push away something from ourself. That's also based on this view of duality of, you know, mind and objects or self and other. Does that make sense? So these last three precepts are not non-possessiveness, non-anger, and not disparaging the three treasures is this version of delusion. So we'll pull these out one at a time. So this eighth is literally it from the Brahmanet Sutra, where these come from, not being possessive of dharma or wealth. So we often say not being possessive of anything, which includes everything very nicely, but the precept itself mentions these two types of possessiveness, or we could also translate it as stinginess or hoarding, or being avaricious, all these words. So the sutra says, a disciple of Buddha is not possessive and does not encourage others to be possessive or stingy. One should not create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of possessiveness. A bodhisattva, whenever a destitute person comes for help, ought to give that person what he or she needs. If instead, out of anger and resentment, one denies all assistance, refusing to help with even a penny, a needle, a blade of grass, or even a single sentence or verse or phrase of dharma, but instead scolds and abuses that person, one commits this defeat, this parajika offense. So, when... Yes? Yes.
If the individual that is impoverished or destitute and their dharma is to receive scolding, the bodhisattva is the bodhisattva actually can correct them.
What do you mean their dharma is to receive scolding?
There is somehow or another they need...
They need scolding. It would be helpful for them.
It would be helpful for them.
Yeah. So we've talked about with these, with each of these precepts, there's these three different kind of levels or ways of viewing them. Each one of them has we could say like the conventional level or maybe even literal level, which is just as it says, not being possessive of dharma or wealth, literally, period. It's the most basic one. Generally, we try to follow that. And then there's the compassionate level, which is usually in accord with the literal, but sometimes goes against it. And the point of view of the bodhisattva is it's always we're trying to benefit beings, no matter what, even if it goes against the literal precept. So I think an example with this one of the compassionate meaning that might go against the literal would be something like this. Like you mentioned, we could say holding something back, actually, maybe even being possessive of something that would actually harm the person, or, you know, maybe scolding them if it's helpful, if we really know that it's helpful, or being possessive, actually, maybe like, say somebody comes and asks us for a gun, right, or poison. We actually don't give it to them. We're actually, if we happen to have a gun or poison, we might say, actually, I'm not going to give you what you want here. So it's like, we could say it's violating the kind of literal meaning, but it's actually benefiting the person to not give it. And that's with, you know, material things. We could say, what about dharma? Would there be a time when we wouldn't give dharma? Dharma meaning like the teachings of truth or the Buddha. And I think there too, especially something like the ultimate dharma teachings about emptiness, say, like nothing really exists. We have these ultimate truth teachings of the Buddha, and they're very profound and subtle and difficult to understand. So generally, we don't like go up to people on the street who aren't already practicing the precepts, for example, and say, you know, nothing really exists the way you think it does, because they might actually say, well, then you don't exist, so I'll kill you, you know. So actually, we withhold that dharma. We're possessive of the kind of ultimate teachings if people aren't ready for them. I think that would be a compassionate possessiveness. Sometimes it goes against the literal non-possessiveness. And then, so we have the, you know, the conventional or literal meaning. We have the compassionate meaning, and then we have the ultimate meaning of the precepts, and that's unique to the Zen precepts. Is each one of them points to the ultimate truth of non-duality? We could say. So in this one, we could say that the precept is no possessiveness. We could say from the deepest perspective of non-duality, there is no possessiveness. There cannot be such thing as possessiveness, because possessive means like I as a separate person am holding something for myself and not sharing it with others. We could say from the point of view of reality, that's impossible, because we actually include all others. We are the entirety of everything, from the ultimate truth. This boundless awareness actually is all-inclusive. There's nothing outside of it, and therefore we are actually like one being. And therefore, from that perspective, there is no possessiveness. It's impossible to be possessive in a, you know, individualistic way. So, and the point with all these precepts is the Zen tradition emphasizes, let's realize this non-duality where we're not separate. And then if we really realize that there is no possessiveness, then on the conventional level, we also practice the conventional precept of not being possessive in the kind of literal way, it naturally flows forth from the understanding of the ultimate. So that's a unique twist on the Zen precepts. Yeah. So, in this spirit, and this is kind of Zen talk now, from Banjin Dotan, one of our Zen ancestors, says, when we say in Zen, this is a quote from Bodhidharma, the Zen ancestor, says, "You have attained my skin, flesh, bones, and marrow." What he said to his four disciples. He said, "You've attained my skin, my flesh, my bones, my marrow," means like, you have, we've been practicing together, and now you have the heart of understanding that I have, right? So that's like a Zen way of saying complete non-possessiveness. You have my like heart, right? You have my skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. And another Zen ancestor said, "I am thus, you are also thus." And this Banjin Dotan says, "This is the practice principle of not holding on to anything at all. Who gives awakening to whom?" And this is the Buddha's precept of not being possessive. So that's a little bit Zen poetic take on things, but could you follow the spirit of that? In other words, when we share our awakened mind with everyone, that's the ultimate non-possessiveness, particularly of Dharma, we could say. But it's really, it's sharing everything. And it's these classic Zen phrases kind of point to this true non-possessiveness. You might also say this: the ultimate meaning is not believing in this, in the illusion of ownership. Because possessiveness is generally like, there's something that I own or possess that's not yours, and I'm not going to share it with you. But if we actually don't really believe that we individually actually own anything, then non-possessiveness naturally flows forth. Of course, we have the conventions of ownership, and we agree on those, but they're just conventions. Yes.
Do Buddhists talk at all about marketing the whole industry in terms of encouraging possessiveness? Is there any?
There is one teaching I've heard in the that comes to mind from the early Pali Canon, the early sutras of the Buddha, where the Buddha is talking to the lay people, the householders, because the monks actually don't have anything. Actually, they're not supposed to store up anything. They just have the robe that they're wearing and the bowl to collect alms in. But the Buddha talked a lot to the householders too, and he said he would give these. This one teaching that comes to mind is he's talking to like a wealthy householder and says, "You should divide up your wealth into these different, I can't remember exactly, but like four parts, something like this. Part of it you should keep for yourself to enjoy for yourself." So he really did say, that's appropriate. You earned it. Enjoy it. Part of it you should keep to take care of your family. Part of it you should actually support the Sangha and the homeless religious wanderers who live on alms, because that's good for you. We might say these days, like, just making donations to charity. You should give part of your income to that, and part of it you should something like save for your retirement, I think. You might even divide it up, kind of giving to religious people and giving to the poor in general. So I always thought that was interesting, because Buddha's being quite practical and saying, no, you really should have some savings and take care of your family and yourself.
I don't know whether there's no end to how much you can have. You just divide.
Yeah.
It's, you know, an enormous amount, a small amount divided.
It's true. I think in this sutra he did say into these four or five equal portions, which is kind of like, somebody asked him, so he's like, well, how about divide it like this? And somebody might say, well, how about I'll divide it like this other way, but I think it's, the principle is kind of a nice one. Yeah, so in a way you could say, that sounds like a little bit like possessiveness, like you're holding something back for yourself, but the Buddha did say, that's appropriate. It doesn't necessarily say give away everything.
No, I'm just saying that, you know, whether you have a million or you have a million, still it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You just divide it into four parts.
Yeah, in that case, we might say, should there be a sliding scale of taxes or something, right? That's, there's lots of debate about this, right, in our culture. Yeah. If people have a lot more, should they pay a higher percentage of taxes? It's kind of, I think our society generally agrees that that's true, right? Whether it's appropriate or not, just depends on your politics, right? So, around this ultimate meaning too, I found some comments from Koban Chino Roshi, our founding teacher here, and he's speaking, I think, from this ultimate view. He says, you are everything. This means you have no self to limit. Knowing this precept is having this deep understanding. That's a kind of a clear way to talk about the ultimate view. You are everything. This means you have no separate self to limit. Knowing this precept is having this deep understanding. Non-possessiveness. And this division of material and dharma, maybe also based on the Buddha teaches these three types of giving or generosity. We give material things, we give dharma, teaching, or, you know, how point out how things are, and also we give fearlessness. So maybe you can't say possessiveness of fearlessness, but it's a nice list of three types of giving. Giving actual sustenance to help people, giving teachings to help people, and giving fearlessness, I think, is another way to say it, is giving protection from fear, or protecting others from fear is like its own category of generosity. We might even, like, this could take so many forms, like, if somebody's really scared, if a child is really scared, just kind of holding them and comforting them and saying, it's okay, I'm here to take care of you, is a really direct protection from fear. But also maybe like a mosquito on your wall and you're about to swat it, you might like capture it in a cup, you know, and carry it outside. That's a kind of protecting it from fear of death. And this giving dharma, we might feel like, well, isn't that just for like dharma teachers who are teaching? But in fact, we're always potentially giving dharma, giving truth. And I thought this was a nice way of talking about it from Tenshin Roshi. He says, giving dharma is whatever is most beneficial or liberating for beings. That's what dharma is. Right? So we might say, it's sometimes like the Buddha saying, I'm going to teach you the Four Noble Truths of suffering and the end of suffering. But it might just be like, how are you doing today? You know, somebody who's feeling, looks really kind of down and out, say, how are you doing? Or I wish you well, or something like that, is we could say is giving dharma. It's whatever is most beneficial or liberating for beings. Whatever is most beneficial is maybe makes it quite kind of difficult, because we don't know what's most beneficial. But I think just anything that we feel is beneficial, in the truest sense, not just maybe giving a kid candy so they'll get really excited. On the beneficial, on the deepest level, but it might look nothing like spiritual teaching, kind of outwardly, right? And also about along these lines, this is in Being Upright book, the Roshi says, in all your relationships, in each moment, ask the question, what is being asked of me? That's a nice way of thinking about giving Dharma. In all your relationships, in each moment, ask this question, what is being asked of me right now? It's constantly changing, right? People, how do we know what's being asked? But we're just trying to be attentive to that. Our ears are open, our eyes are open. What would be most helpful right now? I mean, that's thinking that way and being willing to respond to that, you could say, is not being possessive of Dharma.
It's like asking, how may I be of service in every moment?
Exactly. How may I be of service in every moment? And maybe very some very small thing.
Yes, I say no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just listened to this guy's like last Dharma talk before he died, and it's like his last chance to speak to a sangha that he's supported for huge chunk of his life, and he's like going over the progression of his disease, and he has like 3 months or less to live, and in this talk he like starts talking about oil, and he starts talking about taking care of the earth. He's like, you gotta take care of this body and you gotta take care of the earth. And it's like, it's his last message to the people, and he just talks, spends like at least half of it, if not more, just like talking about, imagine what it would be like to just leave the oil in the ground. Like, he had done this walking the path of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, and he's like, I'm so glad I could do that while I still have the opportunity to walk, while I still have that ability. I was just so touched by like that. Like, you have like one last talk to give, and you spend it talking about caring for the planet.
Yeah.
This like teaching that the entire earth is the true human body.
Who is this?
Steve Stuckey. Yeah.
So not being possessive of one's time, even one's last days, for oneself, sharing the Dharma in that way for everyone.
Yeah, like one student said that he lost his strength to even see people in person, but he Skyped her on her birthday, and he's like on painkillers to even be able to function, and he sang her happy birthday on Skype. Mm. With like some of the last scraps of his bodily energy. He's like, whoa.
So we can all watch how we kind of hold back and possessiveness and aren't willing to give ourselves completely. Like, I had this opportunity a few weeks ago when, you know, we usually leave our Zen Center bathrooms open during the day, and so I think homeless people gradually find out about this, and it becomes sort of a place you can pee in Santa Cruz. And I think it was at some point we were locking the door, and ironically, as you hear this story, I think I was the one who said, "Why don't we just leave the door open all day?" And it's if homeless people use it, it's okay if they're not making a mess. But then this other day, when I wasn't in the best of moods, I guess, and I saw I was in the kitchen, and I could hear like somebody in the middle of the day, not around Zazen time, kind of banging around in the bathroom there, and I'm like, it's homeless people just using this, and they're not coming to like participate in anything, they're just using the bathroom. And it was like, I could feel like this, a little bit of annoyance. I forgot that I actually had wanted to open to that possibility, right? It felt a little bit like, they're taking what's not given or something, right? No, well, what's given, right? I felt possessiveness. I felt possessive of the Zen Center bathroom. And I was like, well, you know, I'll just let it go. And then as I was still working in the kitchen, another homeless person walked up and kind of like knocked on the door, but there was one in there already, right? And I'm like, well, they're coming at the same time. They must be friends. And one probably told the other about it. And somehow the second person coming was like enough that it like kind of like pushed my possessiveness button enough to actually like open the door and just say, like, you know, I tried to be kind about it, but I said, you know, this isn't really like just a general public restroom. It's for people who are coming to practice here, and so you're welcome to come to any of our events here, and you can meditate in the garden and use the bathroom as you wish, but it's not just a general use thing. And even trying to say it politely, of course, he was not happy. Right? And then his friend came out, and who got to use the bathroom, right? Well, then forget it, and like, you people aren't real Buddhists, at least you're not. And he really was kind of laid into it, and afterwards I felt so bad. I'm like, why did I need to say anything, right? He's like, it's not, if they were making a big mess, I think it would be different. But it showed me, like, my possessiveness of, you know, and thinking, you know, forgetting how difficult it is to be a homeless person, right? And where you can't find a place to pee, and or pee or more. Yeah.
Seems like it's also about expectations. You think, well, the people who come to practice here are the ones who, you know. So if you want to come practice, that's the way it works. You practice, you get a bathroom.
Yeah.
If you don't practice, you don't get a bathroom.
That's right. And in fact, that's what they were made. They were built, extra bathrooms for people to come practice. But we could look at it in this other way of like, we actually are supplying a public bathroom. Maybe that would be a nice service since we have them. To really even advertise them. I think it was a similar point around. I've heard homeless people talk about soup kitchens, and some of them are connected with a church where you have to listen to a sermon if you're going to receive the meal. And I've heard people say to me, like, I don't go there anymore because, like, I feel like I'm just coming for food. And, like, the fact that I have to, it feels like coercion. And, like, it's a deal. It's not just freely giving. And I'm like, it's good to hear this around this kind of thing, right? And religious institutions, it's easy for us to lose track of that. And I think I did lose track of that in this example at the bathroom. So, and then it was a good lesson for me, and I think I probably wouldn't say that again in that same way. And he showed, he was a bodhisattva for me too, because if he just said, okay, thanks, no problem, I would be like, yeah, we covered that one. But instead he's like, you know, I know Patrick, he's a real Buddhist. He's kind to me. but you, whoever you are. And I'm like, I thought that was good teaching for me, right? It's like, yeah, you're right. I'm actually kind of, in a way, violating this bodhisattva precept on some level right now. And I didn't notice it until this random homeless person pointed it out to me. I think it's helpful sometimes, right?
Over here. Question.
Yeah.
Is it the goal of every Buddhist to be a bodhisattva?
In the the Mahayana. Mm-hmm. So there's these different paths of Buddhism. So Theravada doesn't speak that way. I think the modern Theravada world, they maybe have the vow, I think, to be compassionate, or the wish to be open and compassionate. Everybody does, actually. Mm-hmm. But I think Mahayana Buddhism is specifically, it's Mahayana means the great vehicle, so it's this later inspiration kind of evolving out of the early Buddhist path to say, we can't really be completely free from suffering unless everybody is. And therefore we vow to help everybody be free from every possible suffering, whatever that takes. And so strictly speaking, bodhisattva vow is not even just to relieve suffering, but it's to, ultimately and permanently, relieve all suffering, which means bringing all beings to complete nirvana, like the cessation of suffering. Actually bringing beings to Buddhahood, where they not only are free from suffering, but they can help all beings in infinite possible ways. So it's kind of almost like an impossible vow. But that's the spirit of, we want to stay that open and non-self-centered, right, is I think the point. So here's a nice story from Dogen, our Japanese ancestor, about non-possessiveness from the record of things heard, the Zui Monki. The Zen teacher Eisai was at Keninji, a poor person came and said, "My family is so destitute, we have had nothing to eat for several days, and my wife and children are really on the edge of starvation. Please have compassion on us." At that time, there was no clothing, food, or other possessions in the temple. And I think that in the 1200s in Japan, it really was like a very poor time in the country. So it could really be true that there's still monks practicing here, but they have almost nothing. And the people around them are also really poor. And the abbot, Eisai, contemplated what to do. But there was a little bit of copper metal allocated for making the halo for a Buddha statue. This metal that they were constructing, this Buddha statue. And Eisai took the copper and broke it up and rolled it up and gave it to the poor person, telling him to exchange it for food to relieve his family's hunger. And the man, of course, was delighted and left. And Eisai's disciples, however, reproached him, saying, "Well, there's nothing other than the halo for the statue of the Buddha. You gave it away to that poor person. Is it not a fault to use the Buddha's property for personal use? Are you taking from the Buddha?" And Eisai replied, "Yes, it is actually a fault. Yet, think of the Buddha's intention. The Buddha was willing to offer his whole body to living beings. Even if we gave the whole body of the Buddha to people who are actually about to die of starvation, such an action would certainly be in accord with the Buddha's intention. But even if I fall into hell or some great suffering state because of this action, I've just saved living beings from starvation, and I'm happy about it." And so Dogen says, we should all consider this innermost heart of this venerable predecessor. Yeah. So this would be like giving away the... It's kind of like looking at the point of religious institutions, right? Like, well, we got to build the Buddha statue nicely, right? And so, but there's people starving around us all the time. So I think this is always a question of how far do we go? Because maybe the Buddha actually is really inspiring to people. I think I often hear it as that's the argument for building a nice temple, is we want to really help support people's practice and inspire them to practice. So that's a valuable thing to benefit beings too. Or, you know, how much do we give away of the temple to help the poor? And some people would go quite far, maybe like Francis of Assisi or someone, right? So, what's realistic? Dogen tells another story about Eisai, very similar, when the temple completely ran out of food, and at this time one of the temple supporters invited Eisai over and offered him a bolt of silk, and Eisai rejoiced and carried it back to the temple. Instead of having someone else carry it for him, he carried it back himself. He gave it to the temple officer who was in charge and told him to pay for the following morning's breakfast for the monks. Finally, we'll have a good breakfast because we're like on the verge of starvation ourselves. And then, lo and behold, a certain layperson came to the temple. Eisai was maybe known for being a generous guy. Yeah, exactly. And this person said, "Actually, a shameful affair happened. So I need a few bolts of silk. If you have any, could you lend me? Could you give them to me?" It's even maybe a higher thing. Instead of saying my family's starving, like a shameful thing, I don't know what, like maybe I was gambling and I lost everything I had and now my family is going to go hungry and I shouldn't have done it, but I did. Can I have some silk? Mm-hmm. Maybe it would be an example. We don't know what shameful affair. But Esai immediately took back the silk from the temple officer and gave it to the person. And again, the officer and all the other monks were extremely upset. And Esai said, you may think it was wrong. However, my thinking is that you monks gather together here because of your aspiration for the Buddha way. It should not matter even if we run out of food and starve to death. It's more beneficial to save people in the secular world right now who are suffering from a lack of something they need. And again, Dogen praises this. So I thought that's an interesting point too. It's like, we should be willing to give up more as practitioners. Like, we have our practice to rely on. So if we're really hungry, let's just go into samadhi. But this person doesn't have samadhi. You know, or whatever. We have our bodhisattva vow. This is just testing us. So again, I thought Dogen tells a lot of these, I think, inspiring stories that feel like they're hard to live up to, but I find them encouraging. And so therefore, Patrick gave up could have been sitting zazen all afternoon, but he went down and cooked a bunch of soup for food na bombs with the assembly.
The line was very long.
You know, it is you know, worth thinking about that. You know, a generous benefactor gave Santa Cruz Zen Center an inheritance that we've got locked away in the bank, and we use the it generates income so that we can take care of this property, you know, all the things that it needs, you know, maybe forever. And you know, that is a good thing, except you think, you know, what other ways could we use, you know, a good large, you know, chunk of money? Should a Zen center have any money at all? Should we, you know, disperse it, the Buddha said, you know, maybe, you know, we'll put away a little bit of it to take care of the roofs for a generation or two, and, we should we give away the rest to a charity, to food not bombs?
what if you put that money to make more money to be able to give on a consistent basis to food not bombs? So that
that's what's happening.
Every so often I will make an announcement on Wednesday nights, our big night. That, you know, why don't people start giving money to our food projects? We raise almost no money doing that, and the Zen Center gives me all the money I need to buy food for the food not bombs and our Friday cooking project. So actually, from my point of view, our food project is generously supported just by, our donations. It could go, you know, any place for copper halos for all our but they do give me a lot of money. But as a matter of fact, you know, we also have this other pile of money that.
How's the balance, right? And it's open questions always. I think it's just good to consider them all. But I think all spiritual institutions, I think probably do some form of dispersing out the giving, and like, how's the ratios going? And you know, we can always critique it, but
I mean, that's what these precepts are. The precepts are really kind of encourage us to wrestle with issues like this.
Yeah.
Not to sort of solve them once and for all.
Yeah, there's no answer. Yeah.
But to say, please, keep this open
question. Remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
I think this thing right now, there's this really bizarre thing called Cards Against Humanity. It's this board game. And they asked for money during Thanksgiving to dig a hole in the ground. Literally, that's all they're doing. It's totally pointless. And that's the point of it. It's completely pointless and ridiculous.
Hmm.
And a lot of people are attacking them, saying like, why aren't you giving this money to charity? And they're saying well, it's your money. Why don't you donate to charity?
Interesting. Well, maybe it just points out too how in our society we do put a lot of money into digging random holes, actually, that don't really serve any function, but we kind of think they do, but they're just pure entertainment or something.
Yeah.
So
it's distressing, I think.
Well, they're doing the things that are gratifying, self-gratifying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, look what I've done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have found it really weird how large of an endowment San Francisco Zen Center has. I think it's in the millions and millions now, if I'm not correct.
And it's a big institution, they're supporting the entire livelihood of hundreds of people.
Oh, I guess.
So I think that's a big, and the health insurance and all that.
In their old folks home, they have a retirement facility for people who've been there for...
Okay.
Is it 25 or 30 years?
Something.
Yeah, they...
Okay, I didn't know. Oh, that's good for me. I've been curious about
it. Yeah, and then maybe too much. Yeah. But, it is... People actually living on very low wages, right? Especially Tassajara.
Yeah.
They're getting health insurance, which is nice, but making almost nothing but working really full time.
Well, but that's part of maybe what I'm saying. Why don't they make more and visit less?
Yeah.
I've heard people talk about how hard it is to be a long time practitioner at this Tassajara.
All these ratios, and I'm sure that the Zen Center has had the same discussion about these precepts and these things, because I think it's, and
the principle of a living wage is a significant principle.
Yeah, and maybe some would say, well, you're living in a beautiful hot springs resort, and you get room and board, gourmet. So this is Dogen's Bodhisattvas Four Methods of Guidance, talking about giving, but I think this applies here too. Giving means non-greed. Or we might say, in this case, giving means non-possessiveness. That's what it is. Non-possessiveness means not to covet or be stingy or possessive. Not to covet means not to curry favor. This is to give away unneeded belongings to someone you don't know, to offer flowers blooming on a distant mountain to the Buddha, or again, to offer treasures you had in your former life to sentient beings, whether it is a gift of dharma or a gift of material wealth, each gift has its value and is worth giving. Even if the gift is not your own, there's no reason to keep from giving. The question is not whether the gift is valuable, but whether there is merit. Or we might say whether it is your true intention. I like that. Even if the gift is not your own, there's no reason to keep from giving. And we might say, again, from this ultimate perspective, the gift is not your own. Nothing is ever really our own. And there are classic teachings, too, that speak about imagining giving. And if we really do it wholeheartedly... imagine making offerings to the Buddha, or imagine giving everything we have to the homeless or something. If you do it really with your heart, sincerely, they say it's basically the same as if you actually give the material thing. Especially when they're talking about giving to Buddhas, because then the whole thing is a little bit more the Buddhas don't need our material things. But the power of the mind, I think, is what this is, and the power of the heart, and if you sincerely imagine it, the joy will be just as great, and the way that we feel about others will be just as great. We might say, but they really, some people really need it. I think that's true. But it's just to say that imagining giving is still an amazingly wonderful practice.
Seems like it's actually an act of love, or it is.
Yeah, yeah. We might even say that would be a fourth type of giving, is giving love.
Giving anything, yeah,
is giving love. Yeah, in a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And it's actually what's happening in a way too, is we are just, our breathing in a way is giving carbon dioxide to plants, right? It's like without our effort even, we're receiving and we're giving constantly. Yeah. Yeah. So to enjoy this process rather than think, I don't have anything to give, or, and I don't want to. It's like, well, we're already in it. Just giving soup. So the next precept is not indulging in anger, or sometimes we say no harboring ill will, or sometimes it's added a second Chinese character that means not taking offense. Maybe that's like the seed of anger, isn't it? Maybe we say not taking it personally, something like this. And literally, actually, we often say not harboring ill will, which means like a real sort of hatred against somebody, not holding it, right? And I think that's a good precept. But the book Being Upright makes the point that really it's a stricter interpretation, is really the literal meaning, just literally says no anger, or not being angry. Whoa, but this is impossible because anger arises. But if we, that's something to look at, is it possible to like take up the training and the practice of not even being angry? And we have to nuance what this means too, because there might be, again, helpful anger. So the Brahmanet Sutra puts it like this: a disciple of Buddha does not indulge in anger or encourage others to be angry. One should not create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of anger. A bodhisattva ought to be compassionate and devoted, helping all sentient beings develop the good roots of non-contention. If instead one insults and abuses sentient beings, or even transformation beings, such as deities and spirits, with harsh words, hitting or kicking them, or attacking them with knife or club, or harbors grudges, even when the victim confesses his or her mistakes and humbly seeks forgiveness with sincere words, one commits a parajika offense, falls away from this precept. I appreciate the part that we might be really angry and the person says, apologizes, and we say, I do not accept your apology. That's like, I think, really going against this. Because it's like, mistakes happen, and then someone is trying to come forth and make peace, and not accepting that is maybe like the worst part. So that's the literal meaning, and then the compassionate meaning, I think we can think of a lot of examples where the bodhisattva should get angry in a certain sense to benefit others. And I think this would be like, political action, even with one's kids in certain cases, there might be ways that they're really not getting a point that's really going to help them, and it might be appropriate to express energy or anger. I think often when this precept comes up in discussion of anger, we start thinking of all these kind of righteous, justified angers. And I think it's good to distinguish two types of anger, or at least I would even maybe define anger in this sense of one of the three poisons in this precept as the one that we're trying to refrain from is the one that's self-centered, always based on a separate self that we're trying to promote, protect, or defend at the expense of others, like that, right? So I think there can be strong, wrathful energy to, you know, against others that can be very selfless, right? Like, we already talked about this in some other, in this class series, and around some other precept, I guess. But I think, like, Jesus and the money changers, I think came up in this, earlier in the series. You know, feeling like, this is my God's house, and what's, why is there all this business going on here? And he's, it looks like he's getting angry and overturning all the tables. But we can assume this wasn't like a personal thing. It wasn't like, you're offending me personally. And it's more like, on behalf of everyone, on behalf of God and reality, wake up. It's like a wake up, shake up. So I might even say, it looks like we might, what we might call anger, but maybe not really anger. And same with like a political protest against something that's really harmful. It might be expressed in a very strong, dramatic way that looks like what we would call anger. But then we have to see, is it like I'm getting like personally, my separate self is getting really worked up here? Or is it like, this energy is coming through this body and mind to protect all beings in a very fierce way, and it's appropriate. Yeah? So it'd be like compassionate anger.
Whether it's coming from love or not.
Yeah, whether it's coming from love.
Because there's a real difference.
Yeah.
I feel the difference.
Totally.
From anger.
Yeah.
Hatred.
Yep.
You know, it's a...
Totally. And I think we can sometimes, it sometimes shifts in any given situation. It starts off sometimes as loving expression, but then in the energy of the crowd, maybe, it shifts into this personal thing without us noticing it. Mm-hmm. I think just because we have such a strong habit of identifying with the separate self, that then it turns into a self-centered, non-loving anger. Or vice versa. It might first be, but I think it usually goes this way. It usually turns self-centered. It's our deep, deep habit. So there are, we could see these compassionate violations of the literal meaning, and then the ultimate meaning of not being angry is like, again, always from the point of view of non-duality, you could say there really is no other apart from this self to be angry at. This person who's bothering me so much is really on the deepest level, really is me. We share this one mind. So it doesn't make sense even. Or another way to take it would be, there's ultimately no, it's like not believing in the reality of, the fixed reality of a, you know, a problem or a mistake or something that the person is doing that's inherently evil, and we might say. But there are some things that are always wrong. Yes, I think this would be, you know, we have to look very carefully if we look at this, vaster view. But it's more like the way things are unfolding according to conditions is just the way they're unfolding according to conditions. So also we might say anger itself, if we say no anger, there is no anger. What is this energy? And we might say on one level, whatever it's based on, we might say it is just this incredible expression of energy that human beings can do, right? It's like this heat rises, the heart starts beating faster, and something explodes out of our mouth and our eyes and our whole body, right? It's like, boom, it's like a storm. And we might say, what is that really? We can't even say. Sometimes it happens like a burst of energy, right? And so Dogen's comment on this, I think, kind of expresses this. Dogen says, comment on this precept from the ultimate perspective. He says, without stepping back, without advancing, without retreating or advancing, maybe these are these ways we react to anger. We try to refrain or we come forward too much. So he says, without stepping back, without advancing, without true or false, there's an ocean of bright clouds, an ocean of solemn or dignified clouds. And this is kind of Zen poetry, but I hear this as, this ocean of bright clouds is like this, you know, energy, mass of storm energy, and, that's what it actually is. And, there's something beautiful about passionate energy in a, coming from love and compassion to benefit beings. Yeah.
I was wondering the word indulge.
Yeah, you know. Like, I came up with that, actually, okay. That translation.
Okay.
And because literally it's, when we say not harboring ill will, I kind of, my feeling about that is, it doesn't seem quite strong enough in accord with the original translation. The original translation, again, is just not being angry or no anger, right? Oh, so it's like harboring ill will is like not that. It's, I feel like I don't actually harbor ill will towards people, but I get angry a lot, right? And I indulge in anger. I mean, I feed it. The indulge part is I thought maybe not being angry is too strict, even if it's the literal precept. I thought for our general use here, I think people might feel like that's too much. Even though the sutra says it, I can't stand it. I get angry if I hear that precept. So I thought indulge in anger is a little bit in between harboring ill will, which seems like so it's such a strong thing to do that we maybe often ill will is sort of like this ill intent against someone, whereas not being angry is maybe almost impossible. But not indulging in anger, I feel like is like feeding it, kind of like I'm angry and I'm justified and I'm going to keep being angry because I should be. It's that now I'm kind of indulging the anger. But if it just arises, I think it's possible. We hear stories about a lot of the Zen ancestors, like Suzuki Roshi, could just get really strong and apparently like shout and get really, seem like real anger, but then within seconds it would just kind of like, hi. He could just like drop it, you know? So I feel like, maybe a beautiful expression of bright clouds and then, but not indulging in like, and here's the reasons. And now it's the next day and I still feel it because why am I angry again? Well, I should be. I can't quite remember what happened. And I think we often do that, right? We kind of keep it going. It makes us feel strong. I think underneath anger is always actually like pain and sadness, but, that feels very vulnerable and kind of we feel weak if we feel sad. Like if somebody is, say insults us, right? It's, they are the strong one and we are the vulnerable one. So we feel, actually that really hurts. It feels sad and vulnerable, but we don't want to feel that way. So in order to match their energy, we're like, let's turn that into anger. How dare you say that to me? And like that doesn't feel vulnerable anymore. But I think behind it is actually this vulnerable wound of being hurt, but it's very hard to feel that.
Especially when you're so angry and you're like really getting into it. Yeah. There's a voice in the back of your head that says, actually, I'm just really sad.
Yeah.
It becomes more embarrassing.
Yeah.
You realize if you were to show how vulnerable you are, the other person would be like, wow, you were just faking it this whole time.
Yeah, they might say that, but in fact, also to put a positive twist on it, I think, if we're sometimes in an argument, right, where both people are getting more and more angry, if one person finally does make the move to kind of express, actually, it just really, really hurt me, then usually the other person's anger dissipates. Mm-hmm. They don't keep it going. But if you keep it going back, they're going to keep it going. Right? But if one person, and it's so hard to do this, right, of course, one person says, you know, I'm sorry, it just really hurt. Then the person, oh, I'm so sorry, why didn't you say that? Because you're attacking me, so I have to defend myself. And then you're attacking me, so I have to defend myself. If we just stop defending the whole thing.
But isn't that also wishing ill will when you're angry like that on the other person?
Harboring ill will and wishing ill will. I don't know exactly what it means.
Because if you're angry at somebody, there's an energy, a force, you know, it's like,
yeah.
You want to hit them.
You want harm to come to them, right?
Yes, because it is an expression of harm. I like being angry. And I know it very, very well. And I used to come in and be able to pollute a room, really. And I, you know, my sense of it now is, you know, it was damaging to everybody around.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't conscious, damaging. It was an attack on everybody.
Yeah.
And
I think I think it does seem like a little bit of extra step. Like often there's ill will with it, but if ill will really means kind of like harm, intent to harm, I think there can be this step of like, I really feel really angry at this person, but I know somebody that I really love, for example, and I know I'm really not going to harm them and I don't want to harm them, but my anger could be really strong still. So I think it could be a slight, they often go together, but I think there could be, the ill will piece seems like a little extra step.
Well, I think it becomes an extra awareness to say,
what
is the anger?
Mm-hmm.
It is, you know, if you look at the anger, you know, what is it doing? Is it harming somebody?
Yeah.
If I come into a room and I'm angry, I'm harming everybody.
Yeah. On some level it does.
See it, what they did or said and not the person themselves. It's like, if someone cuts you, you're going to be like, ah! Wow!
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have to be like the person, you don't take...
That's pain. That's, you know, feeling pain from that. But that doesn't necessarily generate anger.
I'm kind of with Tokyo and Emily on this, in the sense that, like, I mean, I recently had this experience where I was livid at somebody I live with, and I think if I'm honest, there were moments when it was like, I never wanted to like hurt her, be violent or anything, but I think there were moments when I was like, oh gosh, I wish I was harboring ill will. I wish just like something or something. But I think though a lot of the time it was just merely like this person was refusing to understand how much she was hurting me, and that made me so angry. And much of the time it was like, I just wish you understood this. It wasn't like, I want to hurt you. It wasn't like I really wanted anything bad for them. It was like truly like, I'm so angry that you completely refuse to acknowledge how you're hurting me in this particular way. I was so angry about that, and I just wanted her to understand that. And I mean, it was a good practice in the sense that I never got that, and she ended up, and she lived in my house, she ended up moving away for some other reason. Maybe she was distressed by how angry I was at her. I hope not, but maybe. But I don't know. I feel like I echo Emily and Tokyo in this sense. But I also understand what you're saying in the sense that, like, I think it is more helpful. I think it was dualistic of me to, like, say, like one either understands how I'm feeling or they don't. So that's problematic also, but I do think that it's not always that you merely want that. Well, I think they go together, but I don't think it's merely that you want ill of the other always, or you want to hurt them or be violent.
You may not consciously. And, you know, I think
it's possible. It's
really unraveling those emotions of somebody. You know, the depth of somebody hurts you so bad or makes you feel so bad. What's the response?
Yeah. I don't know. I wish I, like, now, I mean, I hope she's happy, and, like, I'm still, like, it still makes me, you can see that it still made me very passionate, right?
Yeah.
But I still think that I just wish she understood. You know, I don't think I want...
Consciously,
maybe,
want to cause ill will.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think that's worth considering.
And I hear,
They're all related for sure.
It's like the two sides of the same coin. You know, it's like that fine edge in that space between that pure anger, like Sensei says. You know, like you know, that just rage that comes up, that energy that comes up and then dissipates.
Yeah,
it's
like
the storm that's been gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, what is that, you know, and
yeah.
It's not directed and
yeah.
Looks and feels very different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Bonjin Dotan says, amongst these 10 grave precepts, there should not be light or heavy. In other words, they're all kind of equal. But this precept especially should be observed. Anger is the most difficult to guard against because it comes so fast. And I think it is interesting to sing, from a bodhisattva point of view, to single out of all these 10. You could maybe do it with any, but there's something about the bodhisattva is so wanting to, it's about non-separation and love, and anger is so opposite. This is a great, the definitive Vinaya is this Mahayana Sutra, that's quoted in Being Upright here. And this is the Bodhisattva Mahayana spirit about greed, hate, and delusion, right? So, the Buddha says, if a bodhisattva continues to break precepts out of desire or greed, we could say, for kalpas, for eons as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, that person's offense is still minor. But if a bodhisattva breaks precepts out of hatred or anger, even just once, his offense is very serious. Why? Because a bodhisattva who breaks precepts out of desire can still hold sentient beings in her embrace, whereas a bodhisattva who breaks precepts out of hatred forsakes sentient beings altogether. That's an interesting Mahayana point. I think in the pre-Mahayana there was a lot of emphasis on desire and craving and like ending desire, and that emphasis shifts in the Mahayana. And also Buddha says in the sutra, desire is hard to give up, but it's a subtle fault. Hatred is easy to give up, but it's a serious fault. Ignorance or delusion is most difficult to give up, and it's a very serious fault. That's it, kind of ranking between these three.
What was the first one?
The first is that greed or desire is hard, very hard to give up, really having no desire, but it's not that big a problem, relatively speaking. Hatred or anger is easy to give up, and we might say, it's not easy to give up, but I think, in a way, I can feel that what he's pointing to, the Buddha here, is that, desire is just like, so, I mean, when we're hungry and we want food, this is like, you can't just decide not to be hungry, right? Whereas, if you're really angry, you can actually can shift your mind sometimes. I think it is easier to give up, but it's a very serious fault. So we might say, if one's not such a big thing, and it's very hard to give up, but one's a really big thing and it's easier to give up, we should attend to that one. And that one's anger or hatred. But then, interestingly, ignorance or delusion is the most difficult to give up, and it's also a very serious fault because it's the root of the other two. It feeds the other two. Exactly, the others come from it. But it's hard to give up, so we say, well, we can work on that slowly. Exactly. That's how we do it. So we're running low on time, but briefly, the last precept is not disparaging the three treasures, or reviling, criticizing, slandering, defaming the three treasures, which are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And Dogen says, the body is manifested, the Dharma is enacted, and there's a bridge in the world for crossing over. I think this is like the ultimate expression of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The Buddha body is manifested already. The Dharma is enacted already. And the Sangha is the spiritual community is a bridge in the world for crossing over troubled water. And Bonjin Dotan says, clearly understanding the three treasures is called taking refuge in the three treasures. And being ignorant or holding mistaken views about the three treasures is called disparaging the three treasures. So it kind of loops back to the refuge at the beginning. Disparaging the three treasures is holding false views about them and or not taking refuge in them. And we might say from the ultimate point of view, not believing in the reality of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha being external to us is not disparaging the three treasures. If we put them outside us, we can say, that Buddha is not quite right, or that Dharma is not quite right, or that Sangha is not so good. But if we say, these three treasures are us, then they're not external to us, then we don't slander. And we could, might say from a compassionate way, we might go against this to benefit others. We might say, similar to the anger one, we might say, actually critiquing, like a Dharma teaching, for example, if it seems to be false, it might look like slandering the Dharma, but it's actually pointing out a flaw to help us understand the true Dharma. But it might look like disparaging the three treasures. So Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sometimes said it's like, Buddha is like awakening, awakening itself. Dharma is like truth, and Sangha is like harmony. So that's a lot like larger sense of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so we don't disparage awakening. It's like our lifeline to freedom for all beings. We don't slander truth because that's what points to how we realize awakening. And we don't slander the harmony of all beings in general, and particularly the harmony of those trying to understand the truth and realize awakening. Because it's like this is how we stay in accord with all the other nine precepts, is through Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and how we live in harmony with beings and benefit others. So in the list of the ten wholesome actions and unwholesome actions from the early sutras that this list of precepts is slightly based on, the mind action is just not holding false views. But this precept changes in a way from not holding false views to not disparaging Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And you could say maybe it's a little bit of like religious,
self-protection.
Yeah, it's kind of like particularly don't slander like the Buddha Dharma and those practicing that, you know. But you could say from built into the system, well, this is the, we might say Buddha Dharma and Sangha is all the teachings of reality that, that and non-duality that open us to actual love and compassion for all beings. And so just to go against those teachings and slander them is like, again, like cutting off our lifeline, or it's ignoring the very medicine that will cure our sickness of delusion and greed and hate.
Does that mean, does that mean that teachers are not criticized and judged?
No.
Okay.
Well, that would be this compassionate meaning.
Because like in Islam, you cannot criticize other Muslims. You cannot criticize the rulers.
Yeah.
Even if they're doing terrible things.
It happens all the time.
but the thing is that in this country, Muslims behave in a certain way, and in the Middle East, they behave in another way. And, when you get...
Yeah, we had these earlier precepts about not speaking the faults of bodhisattvas. So it's kind of related to that, too. And when we talked about that one earlier, we said, well, there may be times when something should be pointed out compassionately, not just to praise self and lower others for oneself, but always coming from compassion and non-self-centeredness, then there may be times to point out faults to benefit others. But in general, it's like around that earlier precept, it was pointed out that that just those who make the vow to try to practice the Bodhisattva way is already just such a great intention. So even if they fail in that, we try to give them some credit that they have this wholesome intention. So I think there's a danger in that, because we could give people too much leeway, but also there's a true, I think, something beautiful about how we're all messing up all the time, but those who are really saying, I really want to live in harmony with all beings, you say, oh, you messed up, but it's okay, we know that we're going to help you get back on your vow, keep going. So the sutra, Brahmanet Sutra, its commentary on no disparaging the three treasures, says, a disciple of Buddha does not disparage the three treasures or encourage others to do so. One must not create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of disparagement. A bodhisattva hearing a single word of slander against the Buddha from those outside the way or harmful beings experiences a pain like 300 spears piercing the heart. How then could one possibly slander the three treasures oneself? Hence, if one lacks faith and devotion towards the three treasures and assists harmful people or those of aberrant views to slander them, one commits a parajika offense. And I wondered, bodhisattvas, when they hear somebody else criticizing the Buddha, they feel like their heart's been pierced. And I want to think, is that like, again, is that kind of religious sectarianism? Like, because I'm identified with, you're insulting my religion. We could hear it that way, and I think if we heard it that way, it would be kind of self-centered thing, right? But if we hear it as they're criticizing the very reality that is actual all-inclusive love and compassion, that's what pierces my heart. So, yeah, that would be quite different, right? That's so painful for me to. It's like they're biting their own hand or something, right? So. Yeah. And we try to open to all forms of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we might widen that to all true, wholesome spiritual traditions that are pointing towards love, compassion, and wisdom, and non-separation, and non-duality. However that's being expressed, let's not slander that. This is what we need in this world more than ever. So, we've brought up the 10 bodhisattva precepts and turned them around. May the merit and positive energy of our contemplation and discussions and considerations emanate out into the universe to all beings, and opening everyone's hearts to the reality of non-separation. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Thanks for joining in the conversation, and thank you too, especially for coming this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good. We got to keep coming back to these, I think. It's endless. It's an endless practice, contemplation.